On Air, presented by Ger Sweeney in association with emeraldconnection.net.
Good evening and welcome. Nice to have your company on this Easter Monday. Are you sick and tired of chocolate, just like I am at the moment? Thought you might be. Do hope you had a nice Easter weekend and were able to spend it with people that you love or like or enjoy the company of. If you weren't, well, I hope you were able to be in contact at some point in some way over the last number of days with those people. Now, coming up on the programme, which is fairly action-packed, it is, I'll be talking to Peter O'Dwyer. Peter will be back talking to us about Brexit and the reaction in Ireland to the recent events in the UK and in the EU. I know we're Brexited out, but it's important to get a little bit of a handle on where we're at with it. Also, we'll be talking to him a little bit about the current political situation in Ireland. Lynn Coyle joins me to talk to me about winemaking in Spain. Now, Lynn is originally from Scotland. She's currently living in Kildare, County Kildare. She's married to an Irish man for many years, and she has embarked on a little project growing grapes and making wine in Spain. We'll find out a little bit more about that on the programme because I spoke to her just before the weekend. Now, there's a wonderful anecdote as well from Patricia Traynor. Patricia talks to us about a lady that you may be familiar with from Irish history called Maud Gonn, and it turns out that Maud Gonn actually features in our history lesson today as well. I'm putting something new in there. There is going to be the number one song from this week, back in 1975 in Ireland. Now, it's not always that you get an Irish artist or an Irish song being number one in Ireland. So I went traipsing through the years and I found that on this particular week, back in 1975, there was an Irish song and an Irish artist at the top of the charts. So we'll hear more about that and indeed about the singer of it as well. Some famous Irish birthdays happening this week. We shall tip our hats to those people. And we have a whole lot more in there as well. Some great music, which will come from the history lesson maybe and from famous birthdays and things like that. If you'd like to contact the programme at any stage, I would love to hear from you. You can contact me by email, ger, at tre.radio, anytime that you like. As I said, I do hope you had a nice Easter. We're all full of chocolate and sugar and bouncing off the walls and things like that. So let's settle ourselves down with a look at some of the famous birthdays happening in and around Ireland on this particular week. We don't have anything today or tomorrow, strangely enough. It's been a kind of a quiet week for birthdays, but Wednesday is the 24th of April. The wonderful actor Aidan Gillen was born in Dublin in 1968. He's 51 years old on Wednesday. Former Taoiseach, former leader of the Fine Gael party, and I wonder what else he will be doing in his time. Enda Kenny was born in Castlebar in 1951, County Mayo. He's 68 years old on Wednesday. And Johnny McAvoy, wonderful entertainer, born in 1945, 74 years old, this coming Wednesday. We'll take a track from Johnny very shortly. Thursday is the 25th, and Peter Sutherland, unfortunately no longer with us, former Attorney General. If I'm not mistaken, Peter Sutherland was the youngest ever Attorney General in the history of the Irish Republic. He was also a European Commissioner. He was born on the 25th of April back in 1946. Friday is the 26th of April. Jimmy O'Dea, wonderful actor and comedian. If you grew up in Ireland any time after the, I suppose, the 30s, you know who Jimmy O'Dea was. He was born in Dublin at 1890. Saturday, the 27th, we celebrate the birthday of Cecil Day Lewis, born in Ballintubber. He was a poet, well-known poet in Ireland, born in 1904. In fact, he was known not just in Ireland, but farther afield as well. And Harry Boland, politician, rebel and GAA activist, was born in Dublin on the 27th of April, 1887. Finally, next Sunday is the 28th, and Nicky Rackard was a famous Wexford hurler. He was born on that day in 1922. So there we go, just some of the people celebrating birthdays this coming week. I did say we would take some music from Johnny McAvoy. I think we should do that right now. I don't know. I think we have played something previously from him. But here's a gorgeous song. It's called I Wish I Had Someone to Love Me. It is Live on Era, the Irish programme, with you through until 7 o'clock in association with emeraldconnection.net.
I wish I had someone to love me, someone to call me her own, someone to stay with me always. I'm weary of being alone. Meet me tonight in the moonlight. Meet me tonight all alone. I have a sad story to tell you. that I'll tell by the light of the moon. I wish I had someone to love me, someone to call me her own, someone to stay with me always. I'm weary of being alone. Tonight is our last night together. The nearest and dearest must part, and all that has bound us together has cruelly been torn apart. I wish I had someone to love me, someone to call me her own, someone to stay with me always. I'm weary of being alone. I had wings of a swallow, I'd fly out over the sea, I'd fly to the arms of my true love and bring her home safely to me. I wish I had someone to love me, someone to call me her own, someone to stay with me always. I'm weary of being alone. I wish I had someone to love me, someone to call me her own, someone to stay with me always. I'm weary of being alone. Yes, I'm weary of being alone.
That's Johnny McAvoy in a great song called I Wish I Had Someone to Love Me. Happy birthday to Johnny on Wednesday, 74 years old. Right, we're going to take a very quick break. Come back to me just after that. And I'll be talking to Lynn Coyle all about growing grapes and making wine in Spain.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney in association with EmeraldConnection.net. Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney in association with EmeraldConnection.net.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, last Thursday, I got an opportunity to talk to a lady by the name of Lynn Coyle. And Lynn is originally from Scotland. She's now living in County Kildare. And she has embarked on a project where she grew some grapes and she made some wine here in Spain. And I thought it was a nice little story that I spotted on the Irish Times and got in contact with Lynn to find out a little bit more about it. Firstly, can I say to you that at the start of this interview, the telephone line is not great, but the essence of what she is saying has not been lost, and we managed to figure it out as we went forward. So please bear with me for the first minute and a half or thereabouts of the conversation with Lynn. And I started that conversation by asking her how she was and how things in County Kildare were.
I'm good, thank you. Very nice day here in Kildare. So bit warm and a bit of sun, so that's always a good thing.
Now, you're in Kildare, Lynn, so tell me, your Scottish accent, and I know from reading the article that you have Scottish background, so will you tell me a little bit about yourself and where you are and how you got there?
Yes, I was born in Scotland, and my parents are Scottish. I was brought up in Scotland, and I first started my career after college going into the hotel trade, if you like. I studied hotel management. I really enjoyed the wine side of that. And once I got a couple of exams under my belt, I decided to go into the wine trade.
Right.
And the rest is history. Moved to Ireland in 2006. So my husband is Irish. Oh. He's got a Donegal and Arco connection in his family.
Okay. So the headline that says an Irish woman in Spain making wine goes on sale. The Irish woman part, do you mind being called an Irish woman?
I don't mind, no.
Oh,
I've been here for quite a long time.
All right. So, and your interest in wine came from... from college?
Yes, I mean, I was brought up in the hotel, and my parents were hoteliers. So hotels were in the background, restaurants were in the background, so food and what. And when I was at college, I was lucky enough to do a module on wine, which tasting module and some theoretical study of wine, and I realised I really enjoyed the talk. You know, when I was left college as a student, I went to live and work in Tuscany for a while.
Okay.
And that really tapped into the wine thing and thought, I need to look further into this area.
Okay. And was there much wine tasting involved?
In Tuscany?
Generally.
Yeah, there was, actually. I mean, in general, for the brands, I taste thousands of wines a year. We're tasting, you know, more or less every single day in the tasting room. And that is actually the major part of the role, is the relationship with the wineries, but tasting the wines, finding the wines, tasting them, and, you know, making sure the quality is what we want it to be for our customers.
Okay. So tell me about your time with O'Brien's then, because you're working closely with them, aren't you?
Yes, I've been working for O'Brien's since 2009. I look after the wine portfolio. So, as I say, the relationships with the wineries around the world. We import more or less from 200 wineries, and the main thing is that we're working mainly with family wineries, which suits us as a family business,
right,
philosophically in size and so on. And we prefer to import directly because it means that we can pass the value on to our customers.
Right. Okay. When it comes to wine, for about 9 months many years ago in a different life, I managed an off-license for a friend of mine who needed a dig out at a particular time. And I sold a lot of wine to a lot of people. But I used to say to people that the best wine in the world is the wine that you like. And sometimes wine is misunderstood, and there's a certain snobbery, if you pardon me, that goes along with it. But wine doesn't have to be as complicated as some people make it out. Sure, it doesn't.
It doesn't have to be as complicated. And I would always advocate that you should drink the wine that you enjoy. Obviously, everything in moderation. And you should drink it with what you like to eat with it. Mm. There are some very basic rules, but really in this day and age, those rules were established when we were having much more traditional fare. And, you know, it was a beef and roast potato or whatever at the weekend. But now we've got such a wide range of foods available to us everywhere. And we're all travelling so much more. And we're getting the opportunity to try different types of wine that we never got to try, you know, even 15 or 20 years ago. So the opportunities are much more wide than they used to be. So I really believe that you should enjoy the glass of wine that you enjoy, and you should eat with it what you want to eat with it. And experiment, you know. That's a great thing. Well, I wonder, will this cheese go with that? Or in fact, would it be better with some chorizo? Or that type of thing. I mean, wine will taste differently depending on the food that you're eating with it.
Indeed. Right, let's talk about Spain and how you got involved, and talk to me about who was with you and how it all happened.
Okay, well, the winery that I'm working with are called Tandem. I've known Jose Maria and Alicia for, I thought, more than 20 years, but they have reassured me it's more like 30 years, which is a bit scary. And I've worked with them in the past, and I knew them when they were both working for another winery, but they left that winery and they set up Tandem, which is actually on the the community of Santiago.
Yeah.
So if you're walking, you would actually pass this winery. And the vineyards that we chose together, they are located in a cooler part of Navarra.
Okay.
Navarra's obviously potentially quite a warm area, but these vineyards are closer to the Atlantic and the Pyrenees. So they tend to harvest maybe 3 weeks later than the rest of Navarra. So you have a couple of things there. You have lovely, refreshing acidity. And that slightly longer time on vine just allows for a bit more concentration of flavours and aromas in the grapes,
yes,
which, of course, then you want to bring into the final wine. Alicia works as naturally as possible in the vineyard. And I was very keen on a couple of aspects that we would do, which was that we would have a very, very short time with the juice of the grapes on the skins of the grapes, which meant that we would have in the end a very, very, very pale colour.
Right.
And the other side was that I was very keen that we use natural yeast because of the textural aspects it can bring, and also just the complexity that it can bring to the wine. But if you were speaking to Lisa, she would tell you that that was very challenging and quite nerve-wracking, because when you're working with natural yeast, you don't have the same guaranteed time for the fermentation to finish or for the just the safety of the fermentation.
Right.
However, it has worked out nicely in the end. We're both very, very happy with the final wine. It's it was a 2-hectare plot, so there isn't a huge amount of wine available. It's a Garnacha wine, and the idea is that we've got this lovely pale elegance, but that we've got a delicious fruitiness to the wine as well, and then a lovely, refreshing, crisp, dry finish, which makes it perfect with food.
Now, will you talk to us about the name Ros, R-O, Fada S? And for anybody that doesn't know what a Fada is, that's the little tick or the little line over a word. You have it here in Spain, you have a backwards one in France, and it kind of elongates. So Ros, tell us what the name is.
It translates from Irish into rose, the flower, mm-hmm. and actually translates from Scottish into rose as well. So Scottish and Irish Gaelic both translate into rose, although Fada is slightly different than the Celtic Gaelic. Scottish Gaelic goes the other way.
Yeah. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. And we were, it was actually my son that came up with the name.
Oh, lovely.
Because we were chatting about it, and I said, yes, I'm just struggling to come up with a name for the wine and whatever. And he's an artist at NCAD in Dublin, and he, being young and agile of mind, he just came up with the name within about 5 minutes of the conversation starting. Having got this Celtic connection, which I was very keen on, then we discovered, because of the Santiago and the winery, the Camino is there, and the winery is on the Camino, and lots of Irish people do that route. I was very keen on this whole Celtic connection. Being from Scotland, in terms of the typeface of the name and the concept of the design, we kind of tapped into arts and crafts movement, and specifically Rennie McIntosh. So, and my son then designed the roses on the front of the label with an influence from Rennie McIntosh. So you've got a real Celtic influence on the label.
It is. And you mentioned the NCAD, which is the National College of Art and Design in Dublin. So Edward is studying there. Is this his first? Is this his first kind of corporate development?
I suppose it is. He's actually studying jewellery. He's actually not painting or fine art. He's a jeweller. But the great thing about the National College of Art and Design in Dublin is that they're very focused on design. He was able to work on the label and come up with the beautiful roses that he came up with.
This is your first foray into winemaking as such, or to growing. Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yes, I completely enjoyed it. You know, studying wine for years, it was the one thing, once I passed my Master of Wine, it's the one area that I really felt that I wanted to get further into. And Jose Maria and Alicia both said to me in 2015, if I wanted to do a wine project, they would be very happy to work with me.
Brilliant.
So it's been bubbling away in the background for a few years, and finally I'm coming to fruition this year. The opportunity of those vineyards, those special vineyards, you know, the name coming together and the whole thing, it kind of, the stars aligned almost, if you like.
Brilliant.
And finally we got it off the ground. So that's the that's what's happened.
It's described as the sassy one.
Oh yes, that's, you know, Brian's, we give all the roses a personality.
All right.
So we have a promotion in the summer, and we have this year 14 roses on promotion from different countries, different styles of wine, and we give them a personality each, and so that people can remember which one they bought.
Lovely.
When you're faced with 14 roses, you can know which one was it.
The sassy one, I know, nice one. Now, I see from the article that there's just over 1,000 cases of the wine made, and although you've received interest from the UK and Australia and Hong Kong, you say that a few of the cases might make their way to places like that, but the majority will be sold in Ireland. But you also tell me that there's a possibility that this will be available here in Spain as well.
That's right. It's basically, most of the wine will be in Ireland.
Yeah.
And there are samples with someone in the UK at the moment and samples with someone in Spain at the moment. In fact, the Spanish retailer approached herself, so we should know within a couple of weeks whether it will be in Spain, and it would be wonderful if it was. So I'll let you know, Jared, if it ends up in Spain.
Do please, and I would be delighted to give it a mention as well, and let people know where it might be available. And can I ask you a question that may be ignorant, but the question is, the grapes that were grown this year for this particular wine, or last year for this wine, will there be further growth on those vines again? Is this a wine that can be reproduced on an annual basis?
Those grape vines will produce grapes every year.
Yeah.
but they won't produce more grapes because if you want to keep the quality right, then you have to keep the yield managed quite carefully. But Jose and Alicia at the moment are looking to find some suitable further Garnacha vines that we could use to make some more wine next year.
Great.
It's not intended that this will ever be a massive, massive wine, and it's more that it's a handcrafted artisanal, and that we can be very, very specific about the quality of the fruit and the quality of the wine that we want to produce. Right. But we would like to produce a little bit more. So Jose and Alicia are on the lookout for some old Garnacha to make some a bit more wine next year.
Lovely. Well, look, we wish you well with Ross. We look forward to hearing from you in relation to its availability in Spain. And I hope it's a great year for you. No doubt you'll be off again very shortly on another project.
I hope so, yeah.
Good. Right.
And dear, listen, thank you very, very much for the opportunity to let me talk about the wine.
Delighted to do it. And I hope all goes well over the weekend in County Kildare. Thanks, Lynn.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
That was Lynn Coyle from O'Brien's and talking to us about her first foray into winemaking here in Spain.
Well, I meant to call you just before I left to go away, but I guess you know that's what I'd say by now. There again, I'm never sure when it's the proper time of day, since we never get together anyhow. But it was really nice to watch the candle through a glass of wine, dream and dream together when the quiet night was yours and mine. Just a pair of fools wrapped up in soft light, dancing from the fire till the morning light sky. I keep thinking that you saw me in the park the other day. When I have the time, I go to where we met. When I'm on the road, I see you in a crowd or by the way. It's gonna take some time before I can forget. But it was really nice to watch the candle through a glass of wine, dream and dream together when the quiet night was yours and mine. Just a pair of fools wrapped up in soft light, dancing from the fire till the morning light whispered in the sky. We can share a glass and look by with a smile. But it was really nice to watch the candle through a glass of wine, dream and dream together when the quiet night was yours and mine. Just a pair of fools wrapped up in soft light, dancing from the fire till the morning light whispered in the sky. But it was really nice to watch the candle through a glass of wine, dream and dream together when the quiet night was yours and mine. Just a pair of fools wrapped up in soft light, dancing from the fire till the morning light would whisper in the sky.
There we go, that is T.R. Dallas and a song called Candlelight and Wine. I thought something appropriate to follow the lovely conversation that I had last week with Lynn Coyle all about making wine here in Spain. And we will keep an eye on that story. And if it is available in Spain, I shall tell you all about it as soon as I know. Let's do a very quick break. And coming up after that, we have a history lesson. And then we will go immediately to Patricia Traynor, her anecdote for today, and the two of them are linked. You can find out how very shortly.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney in association with EmeraldConnection.net. Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney in association with EmeraldConnection.net.
Now, during the break, I did a little bit of calculating and I realised that if I do the history lesson in full, I won't have time to listen to Patricia. So what we're going to do is drop the history lesson for today. But the one thing that I wanted to tell you about, because I mentioned that the lesson was linked with what Patricia was going to tell us all about. On the 27th of April, which is next Saturday, we mark the anniversary of the death of Maud Gonne. It was in 1953 that the Irish revolutionary feminist and actress Maud Gonne died in Clonskee. She was later buried in Glasnevin Cemetery, and she is best remembered for her turbulent relationship with William Butler Yeats. Today's story from Patricia is all about Maud Gonne. So let's take a listen to that.
Maud Gonne's father was Tommy Gonne, and he was in the British Army, and her mother was a lady of nobility. Unfortunately, her mother died when Maud was still very young, and she then became the hostess for her father when he had to entertain. He was sent to Dublin Castle, and Maud was the organiser of the receptions and when they had foreign guests coming. So you think to yourself, a very unusual background for someone who in the end would become one of the Irish patriots. It happened whenever Tommy, her father, died, and Maud was sent to live, first of all, with an uncle in England, but then she had some kind of respiratory problems and they decided that she should go to France because there was a better climate there. When she went to France, she met Lucien Milvoy, who was a journalist and also an activist who was desperately trying to get the French to reclaim Alsace-Lorraine from the Germans. And she was very impressed by this person's passion for doing something to help humanity. Milvoy said to her, well, you could become a Joan of Arc for Ireland. You could help the Irish to get freedom and independence from the English. And she thought to herself, yes, that's what I'm going to do. And so she decided that she would go to Ireland and find some way where she could enter into the politics of Ireland. She got a letter to John O'Leary, and John O'Leary was a bit suspicious of her because he thought to himself, wait a minute, this woman who was born in England, whose mother was English, whose father was in the English army, would she not maybe be a spy? I mean, they were very suspicious of her. Why would she want to come and help the Irish? First of all, they sent her to someone else, and they said that no, that they thought she could maybe do a lot of speaking against the evictions, people who were put out of their houses because they couldn't pay their very high rents. First of all, I have to tell you, Maud Gonne was not an ordinary looking person. She wasn't somebody that you wouldn't notice. She was over 6 feet tall. She had beautiful auburn hair. She had beautiful, fiery, golden, honey eyes. She was somebody who walked like an important person and made a big impression whenever she came into a room. They sent her to Donegal, first of all, and said, well, maybe you can go up there and try and drum up some support for help to stop the evictions. She spoke at those meetings and people were really captivated by her because she had a gift for speaking. She had a charisma and almost hypnotized people. People felt that she almost had supernatural powers. Thousands came to listen to her. Not only was she a wonderful orator and a wonderful communicator, but she also had money. And she then helped to build cabins to rehouse those people who had been put out of their homes. Well, people realised that she was really serious when she said she wanted to become a person who was going to help in Ireland's struggle. When she went to O'Leary again, she met William Butler Yeats, the famous poet. At the first moment he saw her, he fell head over heels in love with her because she was so, for him, was something completely different from the rest. The whole of his life was devoted to Maud Gonne. It's very interesting. He actually wrote 40 poems about Maud Gonne. And if I tell you that he then decided that he would help her in her activities, that he would travel around with her, not because he was really so interested in Irish nationalism, but because he realised that he couldn't separate himself from her. She was interested in Yeats because he was a poet And also because he believed in the supernatural as she did. And so she thought it is very useful to have him with her on her travels. Well, very soon, Yeats asked her to marry him. And she said, oh, no, no, no. You know, we are important people in history. We can't possibly waste our time getting married like other people. We have a role to play and we have got to devote ourselves to this cause. OK, well, Yeats was not really convinced about that. However, he decided to go along with her. Maud Gonne went all over Ireland speaking, raising money, helping, and at various times she was wanted by the police and she was going to be locked up because they thought she was inciting insurrection among the people. She went back to France. Now, what people don't realise is when she had been in France with Lucien Millevoye, she'd actually had a child with him, and it was a little boy. And unfortunately, that boy died when he was just 1 year old from meningitis. She never really recovered from that. She used to keep his little booties that he had with her on all of her journeys. So when she went back to France this second time, she took up again with Millevoye. And this time she had a daughter with him, a little girl called Isolde. Now, suddenly she realised that her reputation might be tarnished because this Millevoye was married already. And now she had had two children with him. She remembered what had happened to Charles Parnell, who had been a wonderful hero and political figure in Ireland, but whose reputation was ruined because he had had, as they saw, an affair with Katie O'Shea, even though she was separated from her husband. But it was the downfall of Parnell. And she thought to herself, my cause of Ireland, I don't want it to suffer because of that. So she was really worried. She didn't know what to do. And she decided to tell Yeats what had happened. Yeats was shocked and surprised. He had never imagined that she had already had two children. However, he thought to himself that he was going to help her, and he did. She started the Irish Association of Paris, and she managed, through Millevoye, to publish no less than 2,000 articles about her work in Ireland and about her speeches, until eventually Millevoye died. Yeats was delighted, because he thought, now there's a chance for me. And again, he asked her to marry him. And of course, she said, no, even now that I'm free, this is my moment that we're really going to be able to work together. And he brought her over to Connemara, and she and Yeats used to lie down on the ground with their ears to the ground, listening to the fairies, because they said that they believed the people who had gone before them were communicating with them. And now, for somebody who was like Yeats, well, yes, he believed in the supernatural and that this was for him wonderful. And they actually said they had a mystic marriage, and that was enough for them, that they were united in this idea of communicating with their ancestors. Maud met John McBride, who had fought with the Boers in South Africa against the English. And for Maud, this was great. She saw him as a kind of a Cuchulain figure, somebody who's a man of action, not like Yeats. But she said, this man who's a battler and a fighter, this is the kind of person I need. She married John McBride. Now, did she marry him because she saw him just as a hero? Or is it that she desperately wanted to have another child, and that she thought he would be a suitable father for this child? Or was it that she wanted the name McBride, which she thought sounded more Irish than Gonne? Well, whatever, they had a son after a year. Then Maud decided to separate from the husband, that she'd got the son now, she'd got the name. Well, she didn't really need him anymore. Now, when Yeats heard that she had actually got married to McBride, he was beside himself, because he thought, I thought she said that she couldn't possibly get married, that she was a woman of action, she was a political activist, and she hadn't time for marriage. And there she goes and marries this chap. However, he offered to help her with the divorce proceedings, doing all the paperwork for her and saying that, yes, he would look after her until that they managed to be able to get everything sorted out. The fact is that the divorce was granted in France, but it wasn't recognised in England. And so she was somewhat worried about going back to England in case they might take her son off her. Her son, incidentally, was called Sean. Now, Sean McBride may ring a few bells, for people and think, oh, I know of a very famous Sean McBride. That is Maud Gonne's or Maud Gonne McBride's son. The next time I'll tell you more about Sean McBride.
I just love how Patricia tells a story, an old yarn. Last week we had the princess and we had Titanic stories and various other things. We're looking forward to more from Patricia down through the next couple of weeks and months. We're going to take a very quick break right now. Come back to me just after that. And I am going to be playing for you a number one song from this week, back in 1975. We'll also be talking to Peter O'Dwyer about Brexit and the current political situation in Ireland and a whole lot more as well.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney in association with EmeraldConnection.net. Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney in association with EmeraldConnection.net.
I was looking just at the charts in Ireland at the moment. The hit parade, as they used to say. There's very little Irish music in it. Yeah, it's kind of sad. And you know what? Back in the 60s and 70s, that was the same because there was a lot of music from America and a lot of music from the UK influencing what was going on the charts. And that's absolutely reasonable and fine. So when we have a number one song that was actually from an Irish artist and an Irish song as well at number one, we like to try and promote it and give it an old spin. And we're going back in time right now because this man has had more than one number one in his time. But on this particular week in 1975, Red Hurley. Yeah, Red Hurley had a number one hit. Now, Red himself started in show business back around 1969 when he was the lead singer or the lead vocals with a band called The Colours. The following year, then, he formed his own band called The Wheels, and they had a number of successes, recording and indeed not just recording, but cabaret and dance halls and things like that. In 1971, he joined a band called The Nevada, and they had wonderful success with Red Hurley, with his wonderful voice at the helm. And then in 1974, he set up his own band, and he had a number of number ones as well. You may remember he represented Ireland in 1976 with a great song called When. But anyway, we go back to 1975, and this particular song was written by Les Reed and Barry Mason. And they wrote a number of songs for Red Hurley down through the years. It was number one on this day in 1975. In fact, it spent 2 weeks, I think, at the number one position. So let's take a listen to the fabulous voice of Red Hurley and a song called Love Is All.
Yesterday, I knew the games to play. I thought I knew the way. Life was meant to be, but now there's you. My foolish games are through. Now at last I have found just what makes this whole world turn around. Until the morning light shines into your eyes, so love me now. We'll get along somehow. Won't you please take my hand, and together forever we'll spend. So take it all,
Fred Hurley and a great song. It's called Love Is All. It was number one in Ireland on this particular day back in 1975. We'll take another one of the weeks. It has been a couple of weeks since we've had a chance to talk to Peter O'Dwyer about what was happening in Brexit. I suppose the break came at an opportune time because whatever was happening in and around Westminster and the reaction to it was world news and everybody knew what everybody was saying. Anyway, Peter is back with me on the line. Peter, I presume you've consumed a huge amount of Easter eggs already, have you?
A huge amount of Easter eggs, yeah. Anything to block out all the ongoings in Brexit and take my mind off it.
Which would give you more indigestion, Brexit or 15 Easter eggs? Probably Brexit. The B word. We talked about many times, Peter, we talked about kicking the can down the road. And God knows it's a very long road and it's a very battered can at this stage. But we all know what has happened over the last couple of weeks. Can you give us a little bit of insight into what the reaction in Ireland has been from the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach Simon Coveney, who's also Minister for Foreign Affairs, and just generally what's been happening in Ireland?
Yeah, so I mean, the Irish government have been pretty happy, at least publicly facing, with the extension. You could see coming up to the European Council meeting that there was a couple of member states, including, I suppose, France mainly, and Macron kind of seemingly spoiling for a fight, whether that was just putting up a front or whether it was real, but kind of making noises about why should we give the UK another extension, or why should we kick that can that we've been discussing about further down the road. But Ireland were quite strong, I suppose, in their support of the need to give Britain more time to get their house in order. So since that extension to October 31st has been agreed, it's been more of the same. Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney have been kind of keen to stress in the few comments they have made about Brexit since that this is a difficult situation and the UK needs to be given time. If you go back to the original, what was supposed to be the original Brexit date in March, when we were coming up to that European Council meeting, Leo Varadkar had said to us before he went into it that the one thing he didn't want was a rolling cliff edge. And it's pretty much what we do have now is a rolling cliff edge. So I think the Irish government are kind of caught in a bit of a bind where they certainly want Brexit over and done with. Now, Varadkar has been stressing kind of in the last month or 6 weeks that not only do we just want certainty for all the reasons we've discussed before for Irish businesses and everybody else in the country, but because it's just taking up so much of domestic government business and so much of European business as well. So every European Council meeting is focused on Brexit. So much of what happens in the Dáil is focused on Brexit. And there's so many other things that are going by the wayside that really he's kind of saying we'd be better served spending our time on. But for the time being, we are where we are and Britain needs a little more time.
All right. And a number of weeks ago, we had a visit in Dublin from Angela Merkel. Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, went to visit Macron in France. And people were saying, Ahadi, this is where the little chink in the armour is going to come. This is where they're going to say, you have to have a hard border. However, it didn't quite work out like that. And there were good soundings from both of them in relation to supporting Ireland. But then last week, we had Nancy Pelosi in Dublin and in London and in various other places saying, lads, if there's a difficulty here with the Good Friday Agreement, it's going to be very difficult for the US to deal with the UK moving forward, that horrible word. What's the reaction to all of that?
As you said, people have been saying for a long time that any day now, Europe or our allies, wherever they be, are going to, at some point, throw Ireland under the bus here, because this is just going to get to a point where something has to give, and the give that'll happen is that Ireland's interests will be sacrificed. That didn't happen. We had Merkel, we had Macron, we had Barnier, and as you say, last week we then had Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives from the US, as part of a wider US delegation that was coming to Ireland and the UK. She was equally supportive of Ireland, and probably even more so than anybody else. She warned, when she was in London at the start of the week, she warned British politicians that there would be no quick trade deal between the UK and the US when Brexit was all over and done with, if there was any prospect of it damaging the Good Friday Agreement. Richard Neal, another of the US congressmen who was over, said that, taking, I suppose, a line from the Irish playbook, that there would be no return to the hard border that we had previously. So this is the great golden goose of Brexiteers, that once Britain is free, as they see it, from the shackles of the EU, they can go and strike all these trade deals with major nations across the world, the US obviously being the biggest and most important. But the third most important politician, I suppose, in the US, and all her colleagues have said, not so quick. You have to make sure that the Good Friday Agreement, above all else, is going to be protected by this. She went to Belfast and Derry and had a similar message there. She went to see the border to get a better understanding, as you know, all these various European leaders have over the last 2 years, of just what an unusual sort of border it is and how many crossings there are. And she also made the same kind of points again as she did on her first visit when she spoke in the Dáil, which was broadcast live as well late last week. So it was a really, really strong support for the Irish position again.
I saw something during the week, Peter. This is an opinion I'm looking for. With the deferral or with the extension to Brexit, is there room for a general election in Ireland? Is there any thought on that among the media in Ireland?
The thinking is that, I suppose there's somewhat divided thinking. Some people are saying that now, if you're going to do it, you could do it quite quickly, and that would be a decent window to do so. I don't think that's likely, because we already have European and local elections coming up in May, so there's not going to be a general election until after that. Then, are they really going to hold one over the summer when people are on their holidays? That doesn't tend to be the case. The Dáil itself is, they're all on their holidays. Probably don't want to spend their extensive holidays doing the hard work and the campaigning, knocking on doors. So you're kind of getting into then, after the summer recess, then you're straight into preparing for the budget. That comes very quickly after that. So again, can't see it then. And then the October 31st deadline is upon you. So I think I don't think there will be one this year. And I think if there is, the best chance is sometime late in the year, maybe November or December. And that would probably be kind of forced upon them by, if there was going to be a scandal like we had with Francis Fitzgerald's last year, if we had with Dennis Nocton, it'd probably be something like that that would force their hands. I think Leo Varadkar would probably like to go to the country before too long, because he still retains a good level of support in the polls, and Brexit is still kind of working out pretty well for him on a domestic front. So I think, and he's just he's hamstrung in what he can achieve with this current government, given the numbers in the Dáil. So I think he would be willing and quite open to the idea of an election, but I just don't really see the window at the moment.
There's usually a backlash to the government parties or the governing party or parties during the local elections. Do you think that they'll be looking at that as a barometer, or will they be taking it seriously?
I think they'll definitely be taking it seriously and definitely be looking at it as a barometer. Yeah, as you say, it's usually a bit of a bellwether for what's going to come down the line with a general election. It's going to be interesting. They're quite fringe, I suppose, still at the moment, but you have the Irish Party, you have a couple of, you have Mick Wallace and Claire Daly, who have been, I suppose, quite effective, but certainly minority grouping politicians, independent politicians who've been in the Dáil. There's a lot of kind of interesting non-traditional background candidates in this, so it'll be interesting to see if there's support out there for any anti-EU sentiment or any of those kind of things that we've seen in the likes of Britain and other parts of Europe. It's going to be interesting across Europe, but it'll be interesting to see, especially if there's any support in Ireland for that kind of stuff.
All right. And finally, maybe an unfair question, but I'll ask it nonetheless. We know exactly what the British media think, but what's the media in Ireland thinking about where next for the UK in terms of Brexit? Maybe a general election, maybe a change of leadership with the Conservatives, maybe a new referendum. What's the general kind of, or is there thinking on it?
I think I'd probably be lying if there was any sort of a consensus. Everybody has their own ideas right. of how best to sort this out in the absence of Theresa May and anybody else actually having an idea to sort it. I think there's a general kind of fatigue with the whole Brexit thing, and it's kind of just take a step back and see how it works out now at this stage, because everybody's sick of coming up with solutions for it.
All right. And listen, with that very same comment, a bit of fatigue with Brexit, you and I had a discussion before we came on air, and we have agreed that we won't be talking on a weekly basis on air anyway, but we'll keep an eye on it and we'll dip in and out regularly. And if things happen, we'll come back and we'll go back and forth and see what happens. But we won't be talking to you on a weekly basis, which is you still get paid.
Excellent. Excellent. That's the most important thing.
All right. Peter O'Dwyer, as always, it's been a joy and hugely informative talking to you. Peter is the senior business reporter with The Times Ireland. And Peter, we'll talk to you again very soon about Brexit and Ireland. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, sir.
And with that, I'm going to bid you farewell for another week. You know, next week is a special week. It's the 29th of April next week. And that marks the first anniversary of Live on Era. Isn't that nice? I wonder, will they have birthday cake here for me next week? After all they spent on the new studios, I wouldn't hold my breath, but there you go. Anyway, that's nice. Just thought I'd mention that to you. I'm going to finish you with this particular song, or a particular song, and I'll tell you very shortly why I'm playing this one. But before I do that, can I say thank you to Patricia for her input today. Thank you to Lynn Coyle, and thank you to Peter O'Dwyer for taking part. Thank you as well for listening to the programme. As always, thank you to our Spanish-Irish cultural consultant. That's Jose Antonio Sierra, and I had lunch with Jose Antonio during the week, and he asked me to pass on his good wishes and happy Easter greetings to the listeners of the programme, and indeed happy to do that. So nice to catch up with Jose Antonio. Going to finish with a song from a band called the Miami Show Band, and I'm sure you are familiar with the name. The van that they were driving as they drove from giving a concert in Banbridge back in 1975 on the 31st of July was intercepted. It was hijacked, basically, and three of the band members, Fran O'Toole, Tony Geraghty and Brian McCoy, were killed. Two other members, Stephen Travers and Des Lee, were injured in that. And I'm playing it because I saw the Netflix documentary about the massacre of the Miami Show Band during the week, and it saddened me and it angered me and it got me thinking about how awful it is that people will do such things to other people, irrespective of what side of any argument you happen to be on. When all the members of the Miami Show Band wanted to do was make music, make people happy, and let them forget their troubles for a few hours while they were at one of their gigs. It just didn't make sense. And I remembered that the lead singer of the band, Fran O'Toole, who was killed on that night, had a solo song or a solo hit with a song called Love Is. And I just thought we should finish the programme with Love Is, just to remind us what love actually is. And if you haven't seen the documentary on the massacre of the Miami Show Band back in 1975, it's available on Netflix. And it's, yeah, it should be watched. But anyway, listen, from me, until next week, I'm going to leave you with this great song, Love Is, and look after yourselves in the coming week and each other. Look forward to your company on next week's programme, which will be our first anniversary live on air. Until then, from me, Ger Sweeney, and everybody at emeraldconnection.net, thank you for listening. Bye-bye now.
Love is warm, love is free.
Ger Sweeney presents Live on Era in association with EmeraldConnection.net.